This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, it's RÚV English Radio. I'm Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company today. I've come to the Skoga Museum, which is very close to the waterfall of the same name. Very hard to miss. And it's an incredibly windy day here on the south coast of Iceland. I'm with Christopher, who's the museum guide. I say it's an incredibly windy day, but it's been worse, I guess, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I've seen worse.
Yeah, okay.
But it's pretty windy.
We're going to have a conversation inside today for that reason, but maybe just detail the different parts to the museum, because part of it is outdoors, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, we have the folk museum here on 3 floors, which is indoors. Outside, we have the open-air museum with turf houses, an old school, and the Skógar Church. And then we also have the technical museum, which is more dedicated to the 20th century.
Okay, so there's a lot to see here. As I say, we're going to concentrate our conversation in this, the folk museum.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That would be great.
So we're standing next to a giant ship, is the first thing to say.
Oh, yeah, this is the ship Pétur's Ey, which translates to English Peter's Island. Mm-hmm. And it was built in 1855 out of Danish oak. They used it for 90 years. And there were actually no casualties on this ship for 90 years.
It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. And they actually had to push the ship into the ocean back then from the black sand beach.
Okay. Let's take a closer look if we can. And how big is this? What's the size of this? Maybe 15 meters?
Yeah, about that.
About that, I would say. And then maybe the same sort of height as well with the two sails here.
Yeah.
You look into the ship and you can see this wouldn't have been a very comfortable place to work or to operate.
No, but they would mostly use the ship as a fishing ship and then also as a transporter. And they would be transporting goods to Vestmannaeyjar or Westman Islands.
Yes, which, of course, not that far from where we are.
No, not that far.
But quite far on a windy day like today.
Oh, absolutely.
Going
yeah.
across there.
They probably wouldn't go out today.
No, I wouldn't go out, certainly.
No.
What do people say when they see this for the first time?
Oh, they think it's really impressive, I think.
It certainly is. And also around here, there are lots of, I guess, agricultural implements and tools, a huge variety of those. What are hanging up on the walls here, these metal items?
Oh, yeah, we have these fish hooks. That would be used to, some of them would be used to hunt sharks and back in the times. And we also have here on the wall a pair of fish skin shoes. And this was during a time when the working class would often wear fish skin shoes like these. And basically back then, people did not talk about distance in kilometers or miles. They talked about how many pairs of shoes they wore during a trip.
It's funny, isn't it? Because fish skin leather has become very fashionable again, and the use of fish skin has become very popular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been getting more popular today.
This would have not been a sort of high-class item.
Oh, no, this would be for the working class.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Looking at the ship that we've just talked about, there's a photograph of it here in use, which takes up much of one wall of the museum. When would this photograph have been taken? Some very stern-looking but well-dressed fishermen on board.
It was taken in 1894.
Wow.
On a very similar ship to Pétur's Ey. And they're all wearing really nice suits on. Because it's a special occasion, because they're having their photograph taken.
Yes, so they've got their best clothes on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And this may very well be the only existing photograph of these men.
Fishing's important all over Iceland, of
yeah.
course. Is it especially important in this part of the country?
Yeah, it was very important for getting food, of course, back then. And people often talked about just the sight of the fishermen or seeing the ship return to shore, people would get like moist in their mouth. Like they would be like, wow.
Yes. And,
yeah.
and every time, of course, these men, and they were men, taking their lives in their hands.
Oh, absolutely. It was a very dangerous occupation, not only for Icelanders, of course, but also for fishermen from the British Isles, France and Germany. And if we would talk about safety equipment for a moment, there were no life jackets on board the ship, no lighthouses had been constructed by Iceland, and of course there was no radio on board.
So they were flying blind, or sailing blind?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
This museum here, then, or this part of it, the Folk Museum, is this about trying to tell their story as much as it is about telling the story of the machines that were used and the ships that were used?
Yeah, also just to show people how everything developed over time.
Yes.
And the founder, Þórður Tómasson, he realized that the world was changing a lot around him, and he had the idea of conserving all the old tools and equipment, because he knew if he didn't do that, then these artifacts would be lost to time, basically.
Yes. And so these have all been donated then? These will all have been in use?
A lot of the items, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, let's take a wander around. And as I say, talking about the people as much as the machinery and the implements, there's a wall of photographs here, maybe 40 or 50 photographs in a frame with everyone's name. Who are these people and why are there photographs on the wall?
These are fishermen that have perished out on sea. And I've always thought one of them is especially sad because it only has a photo of a boat, because I don't think there was an existing photograph of that man. Yeah.
And these are the dates on which they lost their lives?
Yeah.
So 1907 was when this person lost their life. And as you say, there's just a photograph of the boat there, and there isn't a photograph of the person themselves. So their memories live on here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we feel like we should honor their memory to put up this plaque up on the wall.
And have their descendants come along? Have their family members seen their photographs here?
Oh, yeah. Family members have come afterwards, and they appreciate seeing them.
More items that would have been in use. There is a pocket watch with, I guess, that saltwater damage that's made it go brown inside the case, perhaps.
Yeah.
A knife and a bottle and various other items, too. What are we looking at here? The book, firstly. Which is the book?
Oh, it's a story about the ship Pietersey from the period of 1855 until 1888. It's called Dad and Mom. Yeah, I've read this book. It's good.
Another boat, a smaller one on this side.
Yeah, this is the boat Farsæll, and it was built in 1960. And it's a far smaller ship than Pietersey, of course.
And this was used not just for fishing, but for collecting bird eggs and birds themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a lot smaller because of its size. Presumably people could row up to where the eggs were, where the birds were.
Yeah, and then people would also have to go climb up the cliffs and find the eggs. And we also have some tools how to do that in the agricultural section.
Yes, and the catching, of course, of bird eggs is something that still continues. It's not quite as important to the economy as it was, but it still happens.
Yeah, they still do it today, and it can be expensive, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, and over here we also have when people were collecting driftwood in Iceland, which was very important. And people basically had to go to the beach, find driftwood. And after you found it, then you would maybe not have your horse or your equipment to get it back. So you would put on a marking like this, which worked like your home address.
Mm. And they look a bit like staves. Like magical staves, they're not, but they've got that very sort of geometric pattern. So these are signatures, really.
Yeah, basically, to signify who the owner is. And driftwood was floating here from Norway, Siberia, and even Central America.
Yes, I've been to the Sørlandshus, to the northeast of the country. There's an exhibition there about where the driftwood comes from, and so much of it does come from Siberia.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Yeah. And some of it maybe just keeps going round the world, occasionally passing Iceland from time to time. There's a fearsome-looking saw here as well, a long saw, which is kind of scary-looking.
Oh, absolutely. And, we also have the tools to stab the driftwood, and you would attach that to your horse, and then you could drag it all the way back, of course.
Well, it's been a very important resource, hasn't it, driftwood in Iceland over the years. These, I think, are navigation items. We said, of course, there was no radio, no modern equipment to help the fishermen on the ship behind us, but they had, this is a sextant, I think, and a compass as well. This is really all they had to tell where they were.
Oh, absolutely. This is to figure out the direction, of course. And over there we have a navigation tool to estimate the speed of the ship.
How did that work?
They would attach a rope to it, and then they would count the knots, basically. Okay.
There's a metal spindle here, almost, and as that turns in the water, those turns are counted, and then you can estimate the speed of the ship.
Yeah, that's how they talk about how many knots they're going.
Yeah. What's interesting is I think if you showed this to a lot of people these days, myself absolutely included, and said, you know, work out how fast you're going, work out which way is north, we wouldn't have a clue how to operate all this.
Oh, no, I would have no idea. But I only know it about it in practice, kind of.
Yeah.
In theory, I mean.
We'd be reaching for our iPhones, wouldn't we, and trying
Absolutely.
To work out exactly where we are with GPS. So it really does show how difficult life would have been for people who made their living in this way so many years ago. More beautiful wooden carvings here as well. These are wooden panels about a meter long and maybe 30 centimeters high. And again, some beautiful carvings on these.
Yeah, these are all made out of driftwood. And these are bed boards.
Okay.
They were used to keep the linen in its place in the bed, and basically to keep people from falling out of bed.
Oh, I see. So they had a practical purpose as well as being beautiful.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And they usually had like 2 to 3 people in each bed in the turf houses.
Where shall we move next then within the Folk Museum, which is one of the indoor spaces here? Where do you want to head?
I could maybe show you the saddles here. Here we have the side saddles that women used in Europe and also in Iceland.
Again, very beautiful, very carefully designed.
Yeah, and it looks like that picture on the wall. The one on my left is from 1756, and then one on my right is from 1856.
And that photograph, that black and white photograph, is of a hut outside which there are maybe 5 or 6 people all on horses using these saddles. And again, this is a drawing rather than a photograph, but again, very well dressed.
Oh, yeah.
The clothes that people wore, they don't seem very practical for the climate and the difficulty that they would have had.
No, it would be about the fashion, and it's actually the national costume from the 1700s.
So behind us here, we have 3 dresses on mannequins. This is the national costume as was in the 1700s. This is what women would have worn, very ornate dresses with a patterned skirt and scarves, and accessories were very important.
Oh, yeah. The third one was designed in the 1860s.
The one with the veil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it has references to Icelandic nature. The golden tiara represents the northern lights. The white headpiece represents the Icelandic glaciers and the waterfalls. And the embroidery on the dress represents a plant called stone bramble.
And there is embroidery there of some sort of plant, certainly.
And it was designed by the painter and the artist Sigurður Guðmundsson, who he was a spokesman for opening the National Museum in Reykjavik. And he was a part of the independence movement in Iceland.
I wouldn't have spotted that had you not pointed it out, but I can see that, yes, you've got the glacier and you've got the northern lights represented by the tiara and then the plant at the bottom as well. So there was a lot of thought went into these items.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of recognition of pride in Iceland, I think.
Oh, yeah, it is. And this is what the Lady of the Mountain has to wear every year during the National Day, June 17th.
Yes.
Which is, of course, our Independence Day.
Yeah, Fjallkona. She comes from the mountains and, indeed, made speeches at the inauguration of the president last year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that a committee in Reykjavik selects her every year.
Jewelry, very important. There's a beautiful display case here with all manner of bangles, necklaces. Are these hair rings at the bottom?
Yeah, these are silver cylinders or tassel holders. They are for the national outfit in the middle, which was made in the 1800s. It's the most common of them all and the warmest. This was very often the only piece of jewelry that Icelandic women owned.
Okay.
So it was very treasured to her. And this is often a family inheritance item in Iceland, passed down from a mother to daughter.
And so these are status symbols in a way. To own one of these and to look after it was important.
Yeah, and I believe the more complicated the design was, the higher up in society you were. Just like with the belt on the third one, the longer it was or the more links it had, the higher up in society you were.
And this belt, the one that you've referred to there, goes all the way around the waist and then extends for about 6 or 7 links down the front as well. So that's quite a long belt.
Oh yeah, that would be of the upper class,
upper
definitely.
Classes, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is how the class system was displayed, I guess, through items like jewelry, and even items that have a practical purpose in a very difficult society to live in, still indicated someone's stature.
Yeah, and also just the side saddles, of course. Like, I believe if you wanted the side saddle from the 1756, it would have cost you about 20 alive cows. So
okay.
This would be like owning a really nice sports car today.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to do the calculation from cow to krona in my head. Moving through into a different part of the museum. And I highly recommend that you come here and look at this yourself, because there is so much to see. We can only really scratch the surface of one of these buildings. But again, in here, we have more. These are more bedboards, I think?
Yeah, these are more bedboards to illustrate how they looked like. And I believe that the clock over there came from what we call the West Icelanders. I think it came from the United States.
It is a grandfather clock. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, of course, there are descendants from there in the United States.
Also, rugs on the wall, which have been embroidered with various patterns and indeed various messages, and more agricultural implements. And I guess we're into cookery as well here, are we?
Yeah, to make skyr or cheese. Milk, and while you were being a dairy farmer. And we also have some farm artifacts over here, tied to superstition in Iceland, and folk legends. Like, we have these three artifacts over there, which are claimed to have been from the hidden people.
Okay, now there's a lot going on in this case. We have various stones and shells and what look like a pair of scissors. Talk me through some of these items, because at first glance, it's hard to see what sort of ties them all together.
Yeah, some of them were about if you hung it outside of your home, that would protect your house from catching on fire. And some of them would increase the chances of catching fish. And then the three artifacts over there, which are claimed to have been from the hidden people. There was a woman in Iceland who didn't believe in the hidden people. And she dreamt that a hidden woman came to her in her sleep. And she told her that, "You do not believe in us, but when you wake up tomorrow, I will prove to you that we exist." So she opened her nightstand and found these three artifacts, which are claimed to have been from the hidden people.
So the pin and the scissors and the comb.
Oh, yeah.
A gift, and also proof.
Yeah, and it would have been very difficult to acquire these artifacts back then.
And was she then convinced when she got these items that she think, well, I was wrong, the hidden people do exist?
Oh, absolutely. She never doubted it after that.
No. Well, you wouldn't, would you, really, I suppose?
Yeah. But I don't know. I really like the story.
Yeah, it's great. And again, more items here that have been marked according to the owner or indeed the farm that they come from. That was important, it seems. That's the theme throughout what we've seen, that people marked what they had.
Yeah, that's true. They would, of course, claim ownership to stuff and often be proud of their craft, of course.
Tell me a little about the two other buildings that are here, the two other parts of the museum that we won't be seeing today.
Yeah, like we have the Technical Museum, which has, it's
dedicated to the 20th century. So it's about transportation, telecommunication, and energy. And we've actually put up a fun new feature in the Technical Museum. We have some telephones from different time periods that are hooked up to telephone lines.
Okay.
So they can call each other. Yeah. It's really fun to try out.
And you've also got the open air museum that we mentioned as well.
Oh, yeah. They have the turf houses that were constructed in the 1800s. And turf houses, in general, they would qualify what we call earth shelters. And people, of course, have been living in earth shelters since the dawn of time, basically.
As I say, you're very close to the Skogard waterfall, which is just out of the window here. So people will come to see that, and hopefully they'll come to see you here as well.
Oh, I hope so. And I feel like I have the best view in the world.
I think you probably do, actually, because you we came in and you were at your desk looking out on this very blustery day. There's a Christmas tree there tied down quite well, happily, to stop it blowing away. But you've got an amazing view of the waterfall, which never gets boring, I suppose.
Oh, no, never gets boring. And, of course, it has its own folk legend about the Ring of Thrasi. Thrasi was a settler in Iceland during the settlement age, or the Viking age. And he was very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And he hid the chest behind the Skógar waterfall. And a group of people went to the waterfall. They pulled the chest as hard as they could. But unfortunately, the door handle broke off, and the treasure was lost forever.
Oh, no.
And the handle is allegedly here in the Skógar Museum. And we have it here in the Maritime Hall.
So it's safe?
Oh, yeah. The handle is safe.
The handle is safe, but the treasure?
Yeah, if anyone listening finds it, then please give us a call.
Yes, that would be appreciated. Now, you are open throughout the winter. You've got longer opening hours in the summer, but your winter opening hours are when?
It's from 10 o'clock until 5 o'clock. And in the summer, it's from 9 o'clock until 6 o'clock.
All right, we'll put a link up to the museum on the page accompanying this show from Roof English Radio. But good luck with the treasure hunt.
Oh,
thanks very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's Roof English Radio. I'm Darren Adam. You can get in touch anytime. We are english@ruv.is.
There is more from Roof English, with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. Roof English Radio is a daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, Roof.